From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, apprehension over President Trump's plan to revive the citizenship question for the 2020 census.
I really see that this is one more measure of intimidation of minorities and immigrant groups.
More colleges and universities enact so-called mandatory reporting rules for sexual assault. But what of unforeseen consequences for survivors?
We know that, you know, regaining a sense of control and autonomy is really important for healing after an assault.
Remembering State School Superintendent Brian Whiston.
Brian wasn't just a source and someone that I covered, but we were friends.
And a new way to get into a car, not buying, not leasing, but subscribing. Those stories and more today for you on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On the program this hour, instead of leasing or buying, Metro Detroit drivers can now subscribe to get a car.
It is truly month to month. So you have the flexibility to switch your vehicle whenever you'd like or to cancel it when you don't need it.
And we will hear from Rick Pluta as he remembers State School Superintendent Brian Whiston. But first, today a U.S. House committee is holding a hearing to get a progress report on the 2020 census. If the Trump administration gets its way, the next census will contain something that has not been on a census form in some 70 years, a question about your citizenship status. And that has critics on high alert, fearing the question will keep non-citizens and legal immigrants from responding to the census. They say that is an inaccurate headcount that's bad for their communities and for the state of Michigan. With us now, Hassan Jaber. He's executive director and CEO of Access, the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services, located in Dearborn. What were your first thoughts when the Trump administration announced the 2020 census is going to ask us whether or not we are American citizens?
I had fears before the announcement regarding how much we can engage immigrant community, especially with this climate. And when the decision to include the question of citizenship came in, this became a very, very troubling and frankly challenging issue for us as a community when
Why?
It comes to we here in Michigan, 40% of our state budget comes from the federal government based on the census. Based on the data from the census. Frankly, many of the very critical programs, including Medicaid, Medicare, including schools, including infrastructures, will be gravely impacted if Michigan does not have a full count. I think this question of including citizenship is going to add to hesitation, it's going to add to the fear of immigrants regarding participation in the 2020 census. I think the fact that this hasn't been a tested question is very troubling in terms of what impact including this question will be on the accuracy and reliability of the census. I think that taking into consideration the environment, the political environment, the anti-immigrant sentiments that comes from the Trump administration can only lead to discouraging many, many immigrant and hard-to-count communities, including minorities, in participation in the 2020 census.
When you stop and think, the last time that citizenship question was on the U.S. Census was 1950. The 1960 census just asked about place of birth, but not citizenship. From where you sit, what do you see when this question could be added for 2020? What is it you're seeing?
I really don't see a benefit in adding the question. First of all, I haven't seen any justification for adding the question. And till we know what are the justifications from the Trump administration, and we haven't heard this, yet. And secondly, we know that this climate of intimidation of minorities and immigrants, Adam of the question adds much more fears and hesitations. And the fact that really that since 1950, the question was taken out of the census also call into question the how constitutional is this proposal by the Trump administration to add a citizenship question, especially with the fact that the American Community Survey, which is an ongoing survey by the census, do ask citizenship question. So what's the justification? What's the reason? What's behind all of this? Knowing that this question was not being tested in terms of how it impacts response to the census. So,
what do you think the reason is?
I really see that this is one more measure of intimidation of minorities and immigrant groups. I see that it's a way of excluding these populations. I see that it's a way of creating additional concerns and fears among these populations. And I really do not see any benefit in terms of how we can enhance census data reliability and, frankly, integrity of the data.
Hassan, there are people who will insist the United States has a right to know who is here, be it citizens or non-citizens. And they feel if groups of people choose to not fill out the census form, that's their problem. How do you respond to that?
First, it's we do have the rights. These information are available. These information are being collected by the American Community Survey, which is a census.
So you mean the citizenship information?
The citizenship information. So really the logic and justification for including the question is not there. And on top of that, the process that census goes through to include a question on the census is a very exhaustive process. This question has not been vetted by the process. And it really need for us to come back to a reasonable conversation, a real less fear conversation about the makeup of our population and how we really understand who's in the country and what are the needs out there.
There's a group of state attorneys general, not Michigan's attorney general, who are suing to keep this citizenship question off the census form. How confident are you in the outcome of that lawsuit?
I really believe that this question can be challenged on constitutional basis. This question can be challenged in terms of the process and not going through the vetting process and not going through what census needs to steps that needs to be taken to make sure that the question is reliable question and also the fact that there is cost added to including this question in a time when the census budget is shrinking and less funding is out there, in a time when privacy and confidentiality is now being tested and a concern not only among immigrant groups, but among almost everyone in the population. So in terms of the damage that can cause for lack of reliable, accurate census data, damage to communities, to representation, to benefit to communities. So I think that there are some very, very solid ground to push back on this decision.
What's your message to people within the Arab American community about the 2020 census? As we're talking right now with things up in the air, and it appears that this question is coming, what's your message to them?
The census is about representation. The census is about inclusion. The census is about fairness to communities. And the census is about programs and well-being of communities. So for all of that, despite the challenges, despite the fear, we need to participate in the census. And we need to continue to fight while participating that there need to be the protection and confidentiality and the privacy of all communities need to be protected. So on one hand, we still need not to give up on participating in the census and also not to give up on protecting the privacy of all communities.
Hassan Jaber, Executive Director and CEO of Access. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
A reminder, we always love to hear from you. Find out what stories you're focused on or what issues or people you want to hear more about. Just let us know. Find us on Facebook by searching for Michigan Radio. We're also on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Coming up, we'll check out West Michigan music with the Go-Rounds, Lady Ace Boogie, Celtic-flavored music from The Founding, and the Hacky Turtles.
They're sort of like the Red Hot Chili Peppers taking a road trip to the Appalachians with John Mayer.
That's in 10 minutes, right here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Drive commitment free. That's the motto of a Detroit startup offering a whole new way to get yourself behind the wheel of a vehicle. Not owning, not leasing, but subscribing. Tarun Kajapeta is founder of Condor Detroit. So let's talk about this business model. I need a car. How can Condor Detroit take care of that need?
Yeah, so it's actually a pretty simple process. Our whole motto is making it easy to get in a personal vehicle for as little or as long as you need. So you basically visit our website. We have a variety of different packages you can choose from in terms of types of vehicle, the mileage that you'd need. So you select those options, upload a copy of your driver's license, create an account, and essentially schedule a delivery. And you can sign all of our terms and conditions on the website. You can make your first month's payment. We take a $500 security deposit, which is fully refundable, and we'll bring the car straight to your door, ready to drive with maintenance and insurance included.
So what kind of prices are we talking about and lengths of time?
Yeah, so the minimum term's 30 days. The maximum term is really as long as you'd like it to be, outside of maintenance where we'll need to swap your car here and there. But it's a very flexible term. You know, it's completely up to you.
Break it down for us how subscribing to a vehicle differs from, let's say, leasing a vehicle.
Sure. So I think there are a few fundamental differences. I think one is the fact that it is truly month to month. So you have the flexibility to switch your vehicle whenever you'd like or to cancel it when you don't need it. But another big difference is the fact that it includes insurance and includes maintenance, which a lease typically does not. You don't have to go to the dealership. You don't have to deal with the cumbersome shopping process. Everything's digital, and we bring the car to you. So there's a few different benefits that I think, you know, people really value.
Now, who's your prime customer?
It's a tough question, to be honest with you, because, you know, there's a variety of different segments. You have a lot of folks that are new to the area or here for an internship or here from out of town for, you know, a work contract, and it's 3 months, 6 months, and they really just don't have an alternative. And that was the core market that we were trying to address with this product. I think what we're quickly realizing and through our consumer insights research and after being live is that a lot of folks are just fed up with car ownership and would like an alternative. And so you don't necessarily need to be someone who's new to town to value something like this. And we get a lot of folks that are longtime Detroiters that want to try something new.
Where'd you get the idea?
So I lived in Australia in 2014. I was there for 8 months, and I needed a car. And, you know, I basically didn't have an option. I could either buy a car and then sell it 8 months later. You lose a ton of money doing that. Or you rent a car, and it's just absurdly expensive. I ended up buying and selling a car, and, you know, I just thought there has to be a better way to do this. Not everyone needs a car for 3 years or longer. And that's really what I started working on the idea then, but it's only recently that we've started to, you know, my background's in strategy consulting, and I left my job in mid-2017 to pursue this full-time. And it's just crazy how fast things have been moving and really exciting to be a part of.
Yeah, you launched Condor Detroit when?
It was September of 2017, and we've been live since November.
And how have things gone? How many subscribers do you
have? The response has been tremendous. I'm really excited about the direction of this. I mean, we really don't spend a lot of money on marketing because we're just getting so many leads and so much interest by the concept itself. And so since we started in November, we've got all types of vehicles on the road, all types of customers in the area. You know, just on Sunday, I think we had over 600 visitors to our site. So really excited to see the response and excited to continue to grow this in the market.
Why did you launch it in Detroit?
Yeah, it's a question we get really often. Now, the common responses are it's the highest insurance rates in the country. A lot of folks have OEM or supplier discounts, and so how are you competitive?
Right.
I think there are a lot of reasons that this market's actually really attractive. So one, public transit is not a realistic solution for a lot of folks in this area, unfortunately. And I know, you know, there's a lot of effort being put into fixing that. But in the immediate term, people need cars, and it's a high GDP metropolitan area. It's an area where you have a lot of Fortune 500 companies, and so you have people coming in from all over the world, from all over the country, that are new to the area, that need a vehicle, and you know, people that are longtime leasers that want to try something new. And so the demand is actually, you know, quite strong in this area in particular relative to other, you know, other markets in the country. And I think people are willing to try new concepts here because it's a hotbed for new concepts in automotive.
And you are going up against some of the auto companies, right, who have their own subscription services. How do you want yours to stand out?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. Most of the auto companies that have subscription services, one, are not in this market. Two, are at a much higher price point. I think they're trying to appeal, you know, you see Cadillac, Lincoln, all these luxury makes and models that have price points of $1,800 a month, $2,000 a month. And that's just not realistic for a lot of folks. And so we have a much broader offering. We have a cross-branded fleet. Our prices start at just over $500 a month. So it's really affordable on almost any budget. And we try to compete on price directly with the new lease when you consider maintenance, consider insurance, all of those types of things. So I think we also want to represent a lifestyle brand that really challenges and disrupts the current model of how you get a car. And we would like to use existing infrastructure, but we still want
to position ourselves. Now, when you say using existing infrastructure, meaning what?
I think there's a lot of opportunity here to partner with dealers or fleet operators or auction companies. You know, we're not necessarily trying to replace the status quo in terms of the infrastructure that's in place, but we're trying to challenge the way people think about how you get a car. You know, things are changing, and you don't necessarily need to deal with a very cumbersome process to be able to get a set of wheels that you're proud to drive and is completely on your terms.
So give me an idea. You mentioned you can get someone into a car for $500 a month. What kind of car does $500 a month get you?
Yeah, it'd get you like a Ford Focus, Nissan Sentra, something like that. So, you know, a standard sedan that's going to get you good gas mileage. It's going to be a newer model, so 2014, 2015, something like that. And like I said, you know, the winter comes around and you want an SUV, you could switch it at that point in time, drive an SUV for 3 months, then go back.
Where do you get your vehicles from?
We partner with a variety of dealers in the Metro Detroit area. There's one in particular, the Auto Auction Connection in Monroe, who's been really supportive of our model. And so we really try to focus on making sure that we're creating value for our dealer partners and we're creating value for ourselves. Right now, we actually own our fleet. You know, the dealers help us get them at competitive prices, usually from auction, from their lease turn-ins, those types of vehicles. But our goal is to grow that. And so we're partnering with the dealers. Dealers bring assets to the table. We bring assets to the table. And it's a more, you know, symbiotic relationship, so to speak.
Tarun, this is a radical idea. So how are you going to convince people to switch off from something that we've all grown up with, owning or leasing a car? What's your sales pitch here?
Yeah. So you still have your car. And it's on your terms now. And so people like to change their car every 2 years and every 3 years. And lease volumes were not that prevalent 10, 15 years ago. And they've doubled over that period of time. It's because people like the idea of being able to budget, being able to have flexibility. I see our offering as the next extension or next frontier of leasing, where it's completely month to month. It's bundled so you don't have to deal with registering your car at the DMV, all those types of things. And, you know, it's risk-free. If you don't like it, you can always go back. And so I think the model really speaks for itself. It's something that's worth trying and checking out. And, you know, we've had really positive feedback from the customers that have used it to date. So, you know, encourage people to give it a shot if they're thinking about it.
What's your vision for Condor Detroit? Taking it beyond Detroit, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, eventually, if we're successful, that Detroit branding may have to leave us. But our vision is to be the ubiquitous name with car subscriptions. And so partnering with a variety of dealers and other players in different markets to provide people access to this product and ultimately become a brand that represents freedom and commitment-free operations. And maybe we go beyond the world of automotive and we could be a subscription service for all types of products that people don't necessarily want to own because they don't use them all the time. But when they do, they get access to it at an affordable price.
Tarun Kajapeta, who's the founder of the vehicle subscription company Condor Detroit. Thanks for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
A big, big thank you to everyone who came out to the Grand Rapids live show we did last Thursday night. As promised, we're broadcasting those interviews for coming weeks. One of our guests was John Sinkovich, editor and publisher of LocalSpins.com, taking us through our monthly look at the West Michigan music scene. It's so good to have you here.
It's great, and this feels like I'm one of the rock stars that I write about up on this stage. This is a much different environment than being in my basement talking to you via Skype.
The same here. Well, this is great. So we're going to start with a band that you say is as truly distinctive as any band that's come out of the state of Michigan, the Go-Rounds, whose front man, I love this quote, has said his band was woefully inaccessible.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see what's happened to the Go-Rounds. They're from the Kalamazoo area. Graham Parsons is the front man, and this band has probably made more progress and become a more lively and more interesting live band and more distinctive in terms of its sound than any band that we've seen out of West Michigan over the last 5 years. They sort of had this twangy kind of folk kind of thing going. Now they say they're heading more toward the ambient electronic realm. He uses two microphones when he performs, one that has kind of effects on it. And it really adds a very interesting dynamic sort of nature to it. And it's interesting to watch the audience during his shows, too, because they are all involved. When I was up north at a festival performance for them, even other band members from other bands, like the Accidentals, would gather up really close to the stage to watch Graham do his thing. And they just recently released a new EP. They also have a following in Mexico. They perform there fairly regularly. They also released this EP in Mexico as well. And they're also going to be working on a full-length album that's going to be released later this year as well.
Let's take a listen to that new EP. This is Code, and then we're going to be back and talk about it a bit more on the other side.
Darling, I am starving for release. Starving like the belly of the unfit beast. This is a test.
How did they get a strong following in Mexico?
You know, that's a good question. They actually had connections there, and so when they first went there, I think it just sort of developed beyond that. But I'll tell you that their strongest following is here in Michigan, and that's where they really started their following. He's been involved with a lot of other bands as well in terms of cultivating and really helping the band scene in the Kalamazoo area. They recorded this particular album at Stonehouse Recording in Grand Rapids, which is a great little studio in one of the oldest houses in the city, as a matter of fact. I think their new album, he's calling it their best work yet, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun for fans especially because I think they have this devoted, very intense following.
All right, now we go over to Grand Rapids rapper and hip-hop artist Lady Ace Boogie. And I can tell the way you write about her and the way you talk about her, you really like her work. Why is that?
She is a very upbeat individual. I have to tell you that I've met a lot of artists over the years, and to find someone who has such a good heart and such a positive smile whenever she performs, and at the same time, her last album was called Feel Good Music. This most recent album is a far more, I think, a difficult album for her because she talks about a lot of personal problems. She's part of the LGBT community, and so that's part of what's happening here. Everything from, you know, the discrimination that happens as perhaps a female in the hip-hop realm and that kind of thing. But she does such a marvelous job of being able to put that together, not only with her rapping, but on her new album, she's also developing a vocal singing style and melodies that really kind of resonate, I think, with an audience. She recently had her album release show at the Pyramid Scheme here in Grand Rapids. a various wonderful celebration. A lot of other hip-hop artists were part of it as well. She's just a lot of fun to listen to, and she's got a great rapping style.
All right, so let's take a listen to a bit of your magic from Lady Ace Boogie.
Take it one step at a time. Focus clearly on your mission. You're a work of art, just manage the commission. Celebrate your beauty, know your worth, and love yourself. You gotta love yourself before you love anyone else. Come on.
She's laying down a challenge to her listeners, isn't she?
Absolutely, and it's very uplifting. And you can tell from those lyrics, she's trying to tell people to be yourself and definitely rise up above. She takes this vulnerability that she's got and she turns it into something really positive, whether it's, you know, talking about her past troubles and at the same time trying to bring other people up with her music. It's just a lot of fun to watch her perform. And I've seen her in the studio up close. I've seen her, you know, in front of big crowds. And it's great that she is able to sort of take that next step with the sophomore album. I really like what she's done.
All right. Now we change to a Celtic gear with a new studio album from The Founding. And it sounds like this band has evolved from a fun Irish kind of bar band called Blarney Castle to The Founding. So how has that change reflected in their sound?
Well, it's very interesting because they're a Celtic band, but they, you know, and the founder of this band really wanted to sort of, he found other people at Western that he wanted to sort of bring into that Celtic thing. Some people didn't even know what Celtic music was and really hadn't been part of it. He brought them in, and before you knew it, they had sort of created this own sound. The thing I like about them is it's very difficult to find a young band with this kind of exuberance for tradition when it comes to that kind of music, and at the same time making it their own, because they've kind of contemporized what's happened here with the Celtic music. And yet at the same time, anybody who loves Celtic music, and there's a lot of people out here who love Irish music and Scottish music, they will find a lot to like about this band. And they're very young, very energetic, and I love what they're doing with their original compositions.
Well, here is a track called Fox. This is The Founding.
The moment he saw her, he knew that he could not break free. For just as he went so far away, she could run and run just the same. As the storm holds, does the fox know that the wind and the rain are the least of his woes? Just as the bird sings and the bell rings, such is the way of the world.
You can hear from that they're incorporating other world music,
yep.
Klezmer textures,
yes.
A lot of pop. Something that sort of makes them stand out a little bit more maybe from some of the other bands that are in that Celtic realm. But at the same time, they're playing a lot of Irish music festivals.
Yeah, in fact, and they're embraced. We hit a lot of these. We have over the years because my daughter danced, Irish dance. And audiences at these Celtic festivals love when somebody brings in African drums or brings
sure.
in klezmer. And speaking of outdoor music festivals, rollicking Celtic music, tell us where they'll be the Founding will play through this summer.
So they'll be playing at the Alma Highland Festival in Alma on May 26th.
That's
Buttermilk
still going.
Jamboree in Dalton and south of Grand Rapids. And if you've never been to Buttermilk Jamboree, it's one of my favorite music festivals. It's one of the first of the summer. It's a very family-friendly affair. Lots of eclectic, great music at that particular festival. The Plainwell Bandshell in Plainwell on June 20th. And then the Michigan Irish Music Festival in Muskegon in September, which is a gigantic Irish music festival that a lot of people love going to. Wonderful band, and I'm really glad to see them sort of taking that next step, and they're a rising star in the scene.
We're going to wind up today with the Hacky Turtles, which is, I think, my all-time favorite band name ever, the Hacky Turtles from Traverse City.
So originally they grew up in Traverse City. They actually formed the band when they were students in East Lansing at Michigan State University. They moved to Chicago, performed there, and now they're centered in Grand Rapids. They love it here. I think they appreciate the fact that the music scene here in West Michigan is very supportive, and to watch these guys play, it's so much fun. And I think I have to repeat how I described them. They're sort of like the Red Hot Chili Peppers taking a road trip to the Appalachians with John Mayer.
Right.
Just think about that for a minute. But they really do have that Red Hot Chili Peppers vibe, very funky. The lead singer, Mark, is just a very energetic guy on stage, and it's just a lot of fun to watch them play. And yet at the same time, they got this sort of folky kind of basis to them. A lot of fun live. Definitely a band that I would encourage you to see live at any time.
You better take your time.
That's their new single, Grace, that's been released on all platforms, and I know they're working on some new material as well. They're going to be playing in Detroit at E&B Brewery Lofts on May 25, Arcadia Brewing in Kalamazoo before that on May 12th, and then they're back in Grand Rapids on May 31 to play Mulligan's Pub, but I know they got a lot of dates all summer long.
Too fun. So that, just to recap, the Hacky Turtles, the Founding with their new studio album, Form. We're going to be playing festivals all over through the summer. Lady Ace Boogie with her new album, Don't Box Me In, and the Go-Round's new EP, Code. And you can find out lots more about these and other West Michigan artists. Just go to localspins.com, edited and published by the one and only John Sinkovich. John, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. It was so much fun to have you talk
thank
music.
Thank you for letting me be part of this.
Thank you so much.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As awareness of sexual assault on college campuses grew over the past several years, one result is many colleges and universities have implemented so-called mandatory reporting policies. 9 of the 14 schools in the Big Ten, including Michigan State University, designate all employees as mandatory reporters, which means these employees must report any student disclosure of sexual assault to university officials and, in some cases, police, with or without the survivor's consent. A recent paper published in American Psychologist points to unanswered questions about mandatory reporting and the possibility of negative consequences for survivors and schools. Lead author Catherine Holland is with us now. Dr. Holland received her Ph.D. in psychology and women's studies from the University of Michigan. She now teaches at the University of Nebraska. What got you started on this research?
That's a great question. I would say that it is a combination of my work previously as a victim advocate and then also my work doing research while I was at the University of Michigan. I worked as a rape crisis counselor at Rape Victim Advocates in Chicago when I was there completing my undergraduate degree. And sort of what we know about sort of best practices for a trauma-informed response to disclosure is that the most important thing is to communicate that you believe the person, that you support them, and then to find out what it is that they want and need, and then, you know, do what you can to help them get that. We know that, you know, regaining a sense of control and autonomy is really important for healing after an assault.
So I'm hearing you say it's important to let the survivor kind of be the driver of what to do or not to do?
Exactly, yes. It's really about understanding what they need and then helping them get that. And a support person, their response to a disclosure can actually have a huge influence in sort of healing. It can help healing in great ways, and it can also harm healing as well and can actually exacerbate the negative effect of that sexual assault. So, for instance, survivors may stop disclosing altogether if they're experiencing negative responses afterwards. And so when I was at the University of Michigan, I had the opportunity to sort of watch our sexual misconduct policy sort of evolve as they were updating and changing it, and just sort of seeing on a national level, it seemed as though these mandatory reporting policies were getting sort of wider and wider and broader and sort of capturing a larger number of employees under the scope of who is considered to be a mandatory reporter. And as a previous work as an advocate and as a researcher who sort of understands trauma-informed responses to disclosure, I had some questions or concerns about what these policies might mean in terms of survivors' autonomy and control. And I wanted to find out more about them and understand the sort of research undergirding them and to sort of get a better picture about these policies and whether they might be helpful or whether they could potentially be harmful.
So your paper in American Psychologist explores 4 assumptions operating in these college mandatory reporting policies. Briefly, what are those and do they achieve their desired outcomes?
So the first assumption is that these policies will increase the number of reports. So basically, we'll see at campuses, you know, the sort of wider, the broader the policy, we'll have more reports coming to light. And that, you know, then would mean that universities would be able to potentially remedy more cases of assault. They could investigate and adjudicate them, and they could also report more accurate statistics about the prevalence of crime on campus.
And what does the reality show us?
So there's no clear evidence that that will be the case. None of the research indicates, there's no clear evidence that this will surface more reports of violence. And in some cases, it could potentially suppress disclosures, as there's some evidence to suggest that survivors may be less likely to come forward if there are very sort of wide net mandatory reporting policies.
Okay. So what's, and then there is this assumption that this mandatory reporting will help survivors.
Yes. The second assumption is that it will benefit survivors in some way, for example, allowing them to connect with supports and resources. And again, there is a little bit of mixed evidence here. There's some evidence to suggest that in some ways people see some benefits of these. So, for example, it can hold people perceive it as holding schools more accountable, and it could potentially help survivors connect with resources on campus. However, again, the conflicting evidence similarly states that it could actually, again, suppress survivors from coming forward if they're worried about their information basically sort of snowballing out of their hands if it sort of triggers this chain reaction of additional disclosures that they don't have control over. They may not disclose at all for fear of losing control over who knows. And again, it's sort of sharing your story to who and when you want is sort of one last thing to have control over. And again, we just know that that's very important for healing and recovery after an assault. So no clear evidence that it will benefit survivors.
And then there's this assumption that mandatory reporting will benefit school employees.
Yes. One issue is it can be confusing for school employees if they are or if they aren't a reporter. And there's some sort of evidence, you know, if you just make everybody a reporter, there's no question about whether you are or you aren't or whether you sort of wear that hat. Sort of on the surface, that may seem simpler. However, again, there's really no clear evidence that it's benefits employees, and in some instances it can make their job harder. So myself, for example, I would not be able to do the research that I do if I was a mandatory reporter, because I would have to report all of my participants' experiences to the Title IX coordinator, for example. And I even had, currently I'm recruiting participants for a study right now, and during the screening phase, one of the participants explicitly asked me if I would have to report it because she had not reported it and did not want to report it, and she would not want to participate if I would have to do that. So it can hinder research. It can also potentially hinder teaching as well. And more anecdotal evidence of faculty members experiencing issues with students disclosing when they're teaching content related to gender, sexuality, or violence. So it could potentially actually make employees' jobs more challenging. It can hinder this sort of trust-building process, for example.
And then there's this assumption that mandatory reporting will help the institution by basically giving it some protection from legal liabilities.
Yes. The last assumption is the idea that it can help insulate the institution against legal liability. So, for instance, making sure that it is actually in compliance with Title IX, for example. However, and institutions are responding to multiple, often conflicting directives coming out of the Office for Civil Rights. And so it's been confusing for administrators. But on the other hand, there also isn't any clear evidence. So schools are not required to make all of their employees mandatory reporters. That is very clear. And there's some emerging sort of legal analysis. So Merle Weiner, for example, has a new paper in the Tennessee Law Review that is arguing that in some instances it goes against some of the sort of intentions of Title IX in institutional response to sexual assault. So it doesn't necessarily protect schools against legal liability. However, that has been a concern that institutions have had and has definitely been a sort of driving factor behind their expansion.
So here your study finds mandatory reporting policies are built on basically assumptions that are not empirically sound. Did universities do their due diligence in crafting these policies?
I think that is a difficult question, because I think that on one hand, there are, you know, and I've talked to administrators who, you know, really genuinely believe that these policies will do good things. And I think part of the problem, too, is that they're also sort of mirrored after child abuse reporting policies, which people very clearly have seen, can have benefits, for example. However, you know, the vast majority of college students are not children, and so it's not a clear-cut, you know, comparison there. And so I think that they weren't implemented maliciously, if that sort of answers your question. I think that it's sort of this combination of, you know, wanting to believe that this could be helpful, and then also this sort of piece around like legal liability and feeling like this is what you have to do in order to be compliant with Title IX. And so I think the sort of confusion around that legally has been a driving factor. And there are some organizations that have, you know, encourage schools to use more wide net reporting policies or universal reporting policies. The Association for Title IX Administrators, for example, gave a policy template that included a sort of all employee policy that, that schools could use to craft their own policies. And so I think that institutions were sort of, you know, responding to multiple sort of conflicting pieces of information. And I think there are some administrators who do think that these will genuinely be helpful. However, I think that it's important for us to pause and at least evaluate the evidence, because it's possible that these policies will actually do the exact opposite of what some folks are hoping they will, which is to discourage survivors from coming forward and contribute to more of a sort of unwelcome or hostile climate on campus where they feel like they can't actually come forward and disclose because they may lose control over that process.
Finally, as we see from your paper, with universities putting basically all their eggs in this legalistic approach of investigate, adjudicate, rinse, lather, repeat, are there changes you might recommend, and perhaps institutions that could provide an example of how to do it right?
Yes, and I think there are some institutions that have been pushing against these policy approaches and saying, actually, this is not necessarily what you have to do. So, for example, if the goal is to provide services, for example, right, like they think they'll benefit, you know, survivors by connecting them with services. You know, if you want to connect someone with services, reporting to the police or reporting to an investigator may not be the most effective way for that to happen, because they don't actually provide services, right? An investigator has to remain as unbiased, you know, as possible. And so they actually can't give a survivor what they need, which is, you know, complete support and sort of standing in their corner. And so, for example, at the University of Oregon, they have implemented a new policy where they have a small and select group of employees who are required to report disclosures. This is typically people with top levels of leadership or with a lot of responsibility over student well-being and student life. And then the rest of the employees are, they're calling it a student-directed report, where basically what they do is they find out what that does the survivor want them to report it or not, follow what that person wishes, and then help connect them to a confidential source of support on campus who's in the position to provide more of those supports and services that someone might need after healing. And so I think that the goal is to really find more avenues for voluntary disclosures, right, for survivors to feel more comfortable voluntarily coming forward and disclosing, rather than having more of these sort of forced reports where survivors are sort of potentially going to be pushed into that process when they're not ready. And so I think that a policy approach like that is a sort of innovative approach that really is at the heart of what this is about, making sure that survivors are connected with the supports that they need and connecting them with the people who are actually in the position to provide that support.
The paper is Compelled Disclosure of College Sexual Assault, published in American Psychologist. Lead author Catherine Holland is an assistant professor of psychology and also has an appointment in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at the University of Nebraska. Thank you so very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
State School Superintendent Brian Whiston died of cancer Monday evening. He was 56. He had served as state school superintendent since April of 2015. Before that, he was superintendent for Dearborn Schools. In late March, as he was preparing to go on medical leave, Whiston was here with us on Stateside and reflected on his career as a school administrator.
You know, the opportunity as a superintendent to be engaged with students and to brighten their futures because of some policies and plans that we put, that I, you know, was part of putting in place. And having those students, you know, when they see you in the street or, you know, during this illness, I've had students who have written me and thanked me for what I've done for them. So I think that's great.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta has known Brian Whiston for over 30 years. Rick, how would you describe Brian?
I don't think you could sum Brian up in a word, but I've thought about it a lot today. And practical comes to mind. Mm-hmm. That Brian set a, and I should point out that Brian wasn't just a source and someone that I covered, but we were friends. And he set a goal of making Michigan a top 10 state in education. And that's the sort of lofty rhetoric that you often hear from politicians and policymakers, that we're going to be world class, we're going to be top 10 or top 5 or something like that. But when he did that, he did it not as a lofty aspiration, but as what he considered a practical reality of something that needed to be done, considering the size of Michigan, the challenges that we face in terms of educating kids, and just what needed to be done. And so, you know, he not only set the goal, but, you know, he also created a plan. One thing that comes to mind, just by way of example, is the partnership schools, that the state was going to shut down the worst performing schools, the ones at the very bottom rungs. And Brian recognized that that really wasn't going to work, that there wasn't something else ready to slip in and fill the void that would be left if those schools were shut down. And so he came up with the idea of having schools partner with outside entities, outside educational institutions, local businesses, something like that, as one last chance to try and turn things around before you actually shut down the school. And that's kind of the way that Brian approached things.
What kind of career path led him ultimately to school administration?
Brian, he did not start out in education, and he would say, I'm just an old political hack. We first met when he was the chief of staff to a state senator from Oakland County, and from there he managed some campaigns, including an Oakland County prosecutor and stuff like that, and then he became the lobbyist for the Oakland Intermediate School District. And that was what put him on the path to being a professional in the education realm.
When you think about the way he faced his cancer diagnosis, mm-hmm. what struck you most about that?
His stoicness about it. One of the last conversations we had was at a State Board of Education meeting, and a mutual friend had called up and said that, you know, you should head over, that Brian would like to talk to you. And during a break, we adjourned to a side room, and he said, I just want you to know that the news isn't good, the prognosis isn't good, and my plans are to spend the next couple of months trying to, you know, wrap things up, but I'm going to be taking a leave, and I'm probably not coming back. And, you know, it was sad. And then I asked him if there's anything that he wanted to say. And he said, well, what do you think I should say? And I said, I have no idea. This is a first for me. And he laughed out loud and said, it is a first for me, too. Hmm. And that was just kind of classic Brian, you know, that acknowledging the reality of the situation, not getting too worked up about it and getting on with the business at hand.
Michigan Radio's Lansing Bureau Chief, Rick Pluter. Rick, thanks so much.
You bet.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings and engineered by Mike Blank. Our executive producer is Joel Lindstroth. Contributors are Sam Corey, Joey Horan, Gabrielle Horton, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.